Our first reading is Psalm 46, verse 10. God says, "Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth." And then from Mark's Gospel, chapter 1, verses 35 to 37. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him, and when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." On another occasion, Jesus and his disciples were being swamped by people in the busyness of ministry. And so Jesus says to his disciples, "Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place." We live in an age of busyness. We're busy at home. We're busy with family, we're busy with work, we're busy with appointments, we're busy with church, we're busy just for the sake of being busy at times. We live in an age of busyness which has become an epidemic of busyness. Stress-related illness and burnout are ever increasing. Frayed tempers and damaged psyches are all around us, much of it due to this epidemic of busyness. Even if we think we are immune to this plague, we are deluding ourselves. All of our lives are affected. Bizarrely, in the 1960s, a lot of research was done to suggest that by the 21st century, advances in technology would have radically changed our culture to such a degree that people would be working less hours per week, retiring far earlier, and everyone would have more free time. Not sure what happened to that. These technological advances have instead seemingly automated our lives and sped them up. We have less freedom and more busyness. This, however, is not good for us. This is not what is best for human flourishing. The Christian writer John Ortberg was mentored by Dallas Willard. And when he was in his early years of ministry, John Ortberg asked Dallas Willard what he needed to do to be spiritually healthy. And after a long pause, Dallas Willard responded, "You must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life." There was another long pause, and John Ortberg said, "That's a good one. Now what else is there?" There was another long pause. "There is nothing else," Willard replied. John Ortberg recalls this conversation in his book on the spiritual disciplines, The Life You've Always Wanted, and he goes on to write, "Imagine for a moment that someone gave you this prescription with the warning that your life depends on it. Consider the possibility that perhaps your life does depend on it. Hurry is the greatest enemy of the spiritual life in our day. Hurry can destroy our souls. Hurry can keep us from living well. As Carl Jung wrote, hurry is not of the devil. Hurry is the devil. Again and again, as we pursue the spiritual life, we must do battle with hurry. Yet perhaps we're so used to hurry and busyness in our lives that we fail to realize how toxic its effects are on us. Busyness feeds into those insipid human drivers that lead us to pursue success, self-importance, and popularity. Everything becomes timetabled. Everything you do has to be productive. If you're not doing something, you're not leading a worthwhile life. Corrie Ten Boom, though, once said, "If the devil can't make you sin, he'll make you busy." Just think how many people answer the customary greeting of, "How are you?" with the equally customary reply of, "I'm fine, just busy." This epidemic of busyness has got worse in the modern world, yet it's not been isolated to the modern world. Jesus, time and time again, faced the danger of being pulled into the busyness of ministry. As more and more people came to him for healing, for hope, for new life. And this was good stuff. This was great stuff. This was the reason he came. Yet even Jesus knew that he couldn't exist in a state of continual busyness. He was just as human as we are. And he knew his limitations. And he knew too that his disciples would easily burn themselves out with the insipid pursuit of success, self-importance and popularity. And instead he said, "Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place." And this wasn't an isolated example of Jesus retreating from the busyness of ministry to a quiet and solitary place. In that reading earlier from Mark's Gospel, we have these words: "Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up and left the house and went to a solitary place." Jesus retreating to solitary places was a pattern throughout his ministry. In Luke's Gospel, it says Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. Even on the evening before his death, he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane to pray and withdraws from his disciples for a while. Even in those pressurized hours, he took moments. This was the pattern for Jesus. It was a pattern Jesus invited his disciples to join him in. "Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place." And it's a pattern Jesus invites us to join him in. "Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place." The spiritual disciplines we are reflecting upon this week are those of solitude and silence. And these practices flow from this invitation of Jesus to come away with him to a quiet place. We're invited by Jesus to join him in a quiet place, away, for our good, for our flourishing. Now, those of you who are big old E's on the Myers-Briggs indicator, you extroverts might be breaking out in a cold sweat at this time. Alone, away from people, away from doing, panic will set in. But I have to believe that Jesus knew what was best for us, what was best for all of us, introvert or extrovert alike, even if it's difficult, even it doesn't mean it's bad for us all. If it was good for Jesus, it will probably be good for all of us as well. So bear with me. The practices of silence and solitude are distinct but connected, and they're often practiced together. They're a blessing that can be experienced for a few minutes or for many days. But much like fasting, if you haven't tried them before, it's better to start with a few minutes than a many days approach. What does solitude mean? Solitude is when you're alone. Alone with God and alone with your own soul. Solitude can be a physical state, a separation from others for a period of time, but it also can just as easily be a solitude of heart and mind. A solitude of heart and mind that can be maintained even in the midst of a crowd. Because solitude has more to do with an inner attentiveness than outward circumstance. A desert hermit can be alone in the wilderness, yet never experience solitude in their heart and mind. Solitude is not the same as isolation, because in solitude you're not retreating from engagement, but you're actively walking towards engagement with God. In solitude you're acknowledging that you are never truly alone. God is always with you. Solitude is therefore safety. Isolation is danger. In solitude, we are not passive, but are seeking to meet with God. This does not mean, though, that solitude will be an easy ride. Henri Nouwen, writing in his book The Way of the Heart about the wisdom of the Desert Fathers, called solitude the furnace of transformation. And as he says, this is all rather forbidding. But it reflects the reality that in solitude there are only two people present, you and God. And that's a rather disturbing proposition for all of us. Being alone with ourselves is something we all tend to avoid. We become experts at distraction, looking at screens, both large and small, seeking the company of others, both real and virtual, creating endless lists of jobs to fill our time. We distract ourselves from any time alone with ourselves, lest we have to reflect upon who we actually are. And if we are a person of faith, we distract ourselves because if we're undistracted, it might mean that we acknowledge the presence of God. Acknowledge the presence of the one who knows us and sees into our lives in a deeper and more penetrating way than ever any counselor or psychologist ever could. The furnace of transformation is real in solitude because this is where we come face to face with God. This is a crucible where our true self can bubble to the surface, where all of us, good and bad, can be laid bare. In the biblical story, it's telling that some of the most significant encounters between individuals and God come in solitary places. Moses and the burning bush, Elijah and the still small voice. But also we have Jesus in the wilderness, confronted by the compulsions and temptations of the world as the devil comes to him in his solitude. And in solitude, as we're confronted by our true selves, we will also be confronted by our weaknesses, our temptations, our sin. And this is a place we do not want to find ourselves in usually. Yet in the midst of this struggle, we can meet with Jesus as well. In the furnace of transformation, we can meet with our Lord and we can be changed, convicted, forgiven, healed. To be solitary, alone with Jesus for a moment, for longer, can be the place where God brings about a change in our heart and mind. It can be the place where we feel most connected to God. So what might solitude look like in your life? Well, it doesn't require of you to disappear off to a monastery or a convent for 3 months silent contemplation, however appealing that might sound. Although for some of you, that may be the right thing to do. Richard Foster, in his book Celebration of Discipline, suggests that the first thing we can do is to take advantage of the little solitudes that fill our day. Those early morning moments when you might find yourself alone. Your morning cup of coffee. The traffic jam or bus journey. A moment on a bench being attentive to God's good creation. These tiny snatches of moments can easily be lost, and instead they can be redeemed. They can be times for inner reconnection with God. They're not moments, though, to do things, but simply be with God. How else can we find solitude? Well, maybe find a place that is your quiet place, designated for solitude. A chair, a shed, a walk, where longer moments can be taken. Most people have keys to this place. Why not come here for a few minutes with God? And what do we do in these solitary times? Well, it's actually not about doing anything, necessarily. It's about taking our time. It's about letting go, slowing down, breathing, not thinking about what comes next or what has happened, but about meeting with God in that moment. It's about acknowledging how you truly feel, your whole range of emotions, joy and gratitude, yes, but also sadness, doubt, anger, anxiety, and we can bring them all before God. We face the good, the bad, and the ugly of our own hearts. Our worry, our depression, our hope, our desire for God, our lack of desire for God, our sense of God's presence, our sense of his absence, our motivations, our addictions, our coping mechanisms as we reach just to make it through the day. And we let them all be exposed. But rather than letting them leach into the lives of those around us, we give them over to the Father's love in this place of solitude with him. And what of silence? Complete silence without the aid of very good earplugs is virtually impossible in our world today. The traffic noise, the car alarm, the building works, the kids playing down the road, the plane overhead, the dodgy compressor on your fridge, the notification buzz on your phone. All noise that prevents your ears from humming with the din of silence. I used to go on 72-hour silent retreats at Buckfast Abbey in Devon. And it was fine when you were in the retreat centre where everybody else was silent. But as soon as you left the building, you're into the noise of the tourists in the rest of the Abbey complex. And silence seemed to disappear. But actually all this is about, all that sort of thing is external noise. And that's not really about what the spiritual discipline of silence is all about. The spiritual discipline of silence is about finding an internal silence. You can block out much external noise, but it's the internal noise that we all carry with us that's the most difficult to quiet. The voice inside, the internal monologue, the inbuilt call of distraction, the draw of inattention to the slightest disturbance around us. It used to take me at least 24 hours of a silent retreat to find some sort of accommodation with this internal noise and find some silence in my heart and mind. A 6th century Syrian monk called John Climacus said, though, that the friend of silence draws near to God. How we practice silence will be similar to how we practice solitude. We begin by finding moments, by finding spaces. Moments in spaces where the external noise can be reduced, but moments in spaces where we feel comfortable and where distractions are limited to those we carry with us. And in those spaces and moments, we come prepared to offer a time, however short, to turning our ears from the cacophony of the world and our psyche to instead listen to the deafening roar of silence so that we might hear the whispers of God as he speaks his words of love into our lives. Because this is what the discipline of silence is all about. Hearing the voice of God more clearly in our lives. Making space so that we can do this well. Some of us will find this easier than others. Though the more we seek to practice holding silence, the easier it will possibly become. Silence requires us to become better at using our ears than our mouths. Learning what the writer of Ecclesiastes says, that there is a time to be silent and a time to speak. Michael Jankowski writes that silence and solitude are as hard as they are beautiful. Some of us will find the disciplines of solitude and silence easier to practice than others. Yet the invitation of Jesus to come with me by yourself to a quiet place is offered to us all. Offered to us for our good, offered to us for our flourishing. And we need to consider carefully if it is wise to reject Jesus' invitation. I'm going to conclude with a brief meditation on the words we heard from Psalm 46. This verse, in its original context, is about God's peace coming out of the chaos of creation, as we reflected upon in our prayers this morning. But the words, "Be still and know that I am God," have also resonated with followers of Christ for centuries, in enabling them to come and find God's presence and peace as they seek solitude and silence in their lives. So let us hear these words of God spoken over our lives this morning. Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know that I be still and know that. Be still and know. Be still and be still be be still and know that I am God.